claiming it. She doubted the Krakens would be willing to serve anyway, given that she'd killed their princess, her own half-sister. And even if the Krakens did choose to serve her, fight for her. Manon put a hand to the thick scar now across her belly. The iron teeth would not share the wastes. But it was that mentality, she supposed, as she twisted onto her back, peeling her hair from her sweat-sticky neck, that had sent them all into exile. She again peered through the gaps in that hole to the sea beyond, waiting to spot a shadow in the night sky, to hear the boom of mighty wings. Abraxos should have been here already. She shut out the coiling dread in her stomach. But instead of wings, footsteps creaked in the hall outside. A heartbeat later, the door opened on near-silent hinges, then shut again, locked. Manon didn't sit up as she said, "What are you doing here?" The moonlight sifted through the king's blue-black hair. "You don't have chains anymore." She sat up at that, examining where the iron draped down the wall. "Is it more enticing for you if they're on?" Sapphire eyes seemed to glow in the dark as he leaned against the shut door. "Sometimes it is." She snorted, but found herself saying, "You never weighed in."
"On what?"
he asked, though he knew what she'd meant. "What I am? Who I am?"
"Does my opinion matter to you, witchling?"
Manon stalked toward him, stopping a few feet away, aware of every inch of night between them. "You do not seem outraged that Aelin sacked Melisande without telling anyone. You do not seem to care that I am a Kraken."
"Do not mistake my silence for lack of feeling. I have good reason to keep my thoughts to myself."
Ice glittered at his fingertips. Manon tracked it. "Will it be you or the queen against Erewhon in the end, I wonder?"
"Fire against darkness makes for a better story."
"Yes, but so would ripping a demon king to shreds without using your hands."
A half smile. "I can think of better uses for my hands, invisible and flesh."
An invitation, and a question. She held his gaze.
"Then finish what you started,"
Manon breathed. Dorian's answering smile was soft, edged with that glimmer of cruelty that made her blood heat, as if the Fire Queen herself had breathed flame into it. She let Dorian back her against the wall, let him hold her gaze while he tugged the top laces of her white shirt free. One by one. Let him lean in to brush his mouth against her bare neck, right under her ear. Manon arched slightly at that caress, at the tongue that flicked against where his lips had been. Then he pulled back, away. Even as those phantom hands continued to trail up her hips, over her waist. His mouth parted slightly, body trembling with restraint. Restraint, where most males took and took when she offered it, gorging themselves on her. But Dorian Havilliard said,
"The Bloodhound was lying that night. What she said about your second. I felt her lie. Tasted it."
Some tight part in her chest eased.
"I don't want to talk about that."
He stepped closer again, and those phantom hands trailed under her breasts. She gritted her teeth.
"And what do you want to talk about, Manon?"
She wasn't sure he'd ever said her name before, and the way he'd said it.
"I don't want to talk at all,"
she countered. And neither do you, she added with a pointed glance. Again that dark-edged smile appeared, and when he stepped close once more, his hands replaced those phantom ones, tracing her hips, her waist, her breasts, unhurried indolent circles that she allowed him to make, simply because no one had ever dared. Each brush of his skin against hers left a wake of fire and ice. She found herself transfixed by it, by each coaxing, luxurious stroke. She did not even consider objecting, as Dorian slid off her shirt and surveyed her bare, scar-flecked flesh. His face turned ravenous as he took in her breasts, the plane of her stomach, the scars slicing across it. That hunger shifted into something icy and vicious. You once asked me where I stand on the line between killing to protect and killing for pleasure. His fingers grazed the seam of the scar across her abdomen. I'll stand on the other side of the line when I find your grandmother. A chill ran down her body, peeking her breasts. He watched them, then circled a finger around one. Dorian bent, his mouth following the part where that finger had been, then his tongue. She bit her lip against the groan rising up her throat, her hand sliding into the silken locks of his hair. His mouth was still around the tip of her breast as he again met her eyes, sapphire framed with ebony lashes, and said, I want to taste every inch of you. Manon let go of all pretense of reason as the king lifted his head and claimed her mouth. And for all his wanting to taste her, as she opened for him, Manon thought the king tasted like the sea, like a winter morning, something so foreign and yet familiar. It at last dragged that moan from deep in her. His fingers slid to her jaw, tipping her face to thoroughly take her mouth, every movement of his tongue a sensuous promise that had her arching into him, had her meeting him stroke for stroke, as he explored and teased until she could hardly think straight. She had never contemplated what it would be like to yield control, and not have it be weakness, but a freedom. Dorian's hand slid down her thighs, as if savoring the muscle there, then around, cupping her backside, grinding her into every hard inch of him. The small noise in her throat was cut off as he hoisted her from the wall in a smooth movement. Manon wrapped her legs around his waist while he carried her to the bed, his mouth never leaving hers as he devoured and devoured her, as he spread her beneath him, as he freed her pants button by button, then slid them off. But Dorian pulled back at last, leaving her panting as he surveyed her, utterly bare before him. He caressed a finger along the inside of her thigh. Higher. I wanted you from the first moment I saw you in Oakwald, he said, his voice low and rough. Manon reached up to peel off his shirt, white fabric sliding away to reveal tan skin and sculpted muscle. Yes, was all she told him. She unbuckled his belt, hands shaking. Yes, she said again, as Dorian brushed a knuckle over her core. He let out an approving growl at what he found. His clothes joined hers on the floor. Manon let him raise her arms over her head, his magic gently pinning her wrists to the mattress as he touched her, first with those wicked hands, then with his wicked mouth. And when Manon had to bite his shoulder to muffle her moaning as he brought her over the edge, Dorian Havilliard buried himself deep inside her. She did not care who she was, who she had been, and what she had once been promised to be as he moved. She dragged her hands through his thick hair, over the muscles of his back as it flexed and rippled with each thrust that drove her toward that shimmering edge again. Here, she was nothing but flesh and fire and iron. Here, there was only this selfish need of her body, his body. More. She wanted more. Wanted everything. She might have whispered it, might have pleaded for it. Because darkness save her, Dorian gave it to her. To them both. He remained atop her when he at last stilled, his lips barely a hair's breadth above hers, hovering after the brutal kiss he'd given her, to contain his roar as release found him. She was trembling with whatever he'd done to her, her body. He brushed a strand of hair out of her face, his own fingers shaking. She had not realized how silent the world was, how loud they might have been, especially with so many fey ears nearby. He was still atop her, in her, though sapphire eyes flicked to her mouth, still panting slightly.
This was supposed to take the edge off.
She kept her words low as his clothes slid over, hauled by phantom hands. And did it. He traced her lower lip with his thumb, and shuddered as she sucked it into her mouth, flicked it with her tongue.
No, not even close.
But that was the gray light of dawn creeping into the room, staining the walls silver. He seemed to notice it at the same moment she did. Groaning softly, he pulled himself off her. She tugged on her clothes with trained efficiency, and only when she was lacing up her shirt did Dorian say,
"We're not done, you and I."
And it was the purely male promise that made her bare her teeth. "Unless you would like to learn precisely what parts of me are made of iron the next time you touch me, I decide those things." Dorian gave another purely male smile, brows flicking up, and sauntered out the door as silently as he'd arrived. He only seemed to pause on the threshold, as if some word had snagged his interest. But he continued out, the door closing with barely a click. Unruffled. Utterly calm. Manon gaped after him, cursing her blood for heating again, for what she'd allowed him to do. She wondered what Dorian would say if she told him she had never allowed a male atop her like that. Not once. Wondered what he'd say if she told him she'd wanted to sink her teeth into his neck and find out what he tasted like. Put her mouth on other parts and see what he tasted like there. Manon dragged her hands through her hair and slumped onto the pillow. Darkness embrace her. She sent a silent prayer for Abraxos to return soon. Too much time. She had spent too much damn time among these humans and fey males. She needed to leave. Elide was safe here. The Queen of Terrasen might be many things, but Manon knew she'd protect Elide. But with the 13 scattered and likely dead, regardless of what Dorian had claimed, Manon wasn't entirely sure where to go once she left. The world had never seemed quite so vast before. And so empty. Even utterly exhausted, Elide barely slept during the long night she and Lorkin swayed in hammocks with the other sailors. The smells, the sounds, the rocking of the sea. All of it nagged. None of it left her settled. A finger seemed to keep prodding her awake, as if telling her to be alert, but there was nothing. Lorkin tossed and turned for hours, as if the same force begged him to wake. As if he was waiting for something. His strength had been flagging by the time they'd reached the ship, though he had showed no signs of strain beyond a slight tightening in his mouth. But Elide knew he was near what he'd described as a burnout. Knew, because for hours afterward, the small brace of magic around her ankle kept flickering in and out of place. After Manon had informed her of the uncertain fates of the 13, Elide had kept mostly out of her companion's way, letting them talk with that red-haired young woman who found them on the beach. So had Lorcan. He'd listened to them debate and plan, his face taut, as if something coiled in him wound itself tighter with every passing moment. Watching him sleep mere feet away, that harsh face smoothed to softness by slumber, a small part of Elide wondered if she'd somehow brought another danger to the Queen. She wondered if the others had noted how often Lorcan's gaze had been fixed on Aelin's back, aimed at her back. As if sensing her attention, Lorcan opened his eyes, met her stare without so much as blinking. For a heartbeat, she took in that depthless gaze mere feet away, made ethereal by the silver light before dawn. He had been willing to offer up his life for her own. Something softened in that harsh face, as his eyes dipped to where her arm dangled out of her hammock, the skin still a bit sore, but miraculously healed. She'd thanked Gabriel twice now, but he'd brushed it aside with a gentle nod and shrug. A faint smile bloomed on Lorcan's harsh mouth as he reached across the space between them and ran his calloused fingers down her arm.
"You choose this," he murmured, so that it was little more than the groaning of the hammock ropes.
He brushed a thumb down her palm. Elide swallowed, but let herself take in every line of that face. North. They were going home today. "I thought that was obvious," she said with equal quiet, her cheeks heating. His fingers laced through hers, some emotion she couldn't place flickering like starlight in those black eyes.
"We need to talk," he rasped.
It was the shout of the watch that jolted them, the one of pure terror. Elide nearly flipped out of her hammock, the sailors rushing past. By the time she shoved her hair from her eyes, Lorcan was already gone. The various decks were packed, and she had to limp onto the stairs to view what had roused them. The other ships were awake and frenzied, with good reason. Sailing over the western horizon, another armada headed for them. And Elide knew in her bones it was not one that Aelin had schemed and planned for. Not as Fenris breathed, suddenly beside her on the steps.
"Maeve."
Chapter 61. They had no choice but to meet them. Maeve's armada had the wind and the current, and they would not even reach the shore before they were caught. And outrunning Fae soldiers, not an option. Rowan and Adian laid out every course for Aelin. All paths arrived at one destination. Confrontation. And she was still so drained, so exhausted that she knew how this would go. Maeve had a third more ships, and immortal warriors, with magic. It took far too little time for those black sails to fill the sky, for them to glean that their enemies' boats were better made, their soldiers longer trained. Rowan and the cadre had overseen much of that training, and the details they provided were not heartening. Maeve sent one ornately carved rowboat to them, bearing a message. Surrender, or be sent to the bottom of the ocean. Aelin had until dawn tomorrow to decide. An entire day, so that the fear would fester and spread among their men. Aelin met with Rowan and Adian again. The cadre was not summoned by their queen, though Lorkin paced like a caged beast, Aelin watching with a face that impressively revealed nothing. She had no solution. Dorian remained quiet, though he often glanced between her and Manon, as if some puzzle were laid before him. He never said what. Adian pushed for attacking, quietly rallying the boats and attacking. But Maeve would see that maneuver coming, and they could strike faster with magic than it'd take them to fire arrows and harpoons. Time. That was all she had to play with. They debated and theorized and planned. Rowan made a decent attempt at trying to suggest she run. She let him talk, only to let him realize in doing so what a stupid idea it was. After last night, he should be well aware she was not leaving him. Not willingly. So the sun set, and Maeve's armada waited, poised and watching. A lounging panther ready to strike at first light. Time. Her only tool, and her downfall. And she had run out of it. Aelin counted those black sails again and again as night blanketed them, and had no idea what to do. It was unacceptable, Rowan had decided, during the long hours they'd debated. Unacceptable that they had done so much, only to be halted not by Erewhon, but Maeve. She hadn't deigned to make an appearance, but that wasn't her style. She'd do it at dawn, accept Aelin's surrender in person, with all eyes watching. And then, Rowan didn't know what she'd do then, what Maeve wanted, other than the keys. Aelin had been so calm. Shock, he'd realized. Aelin had gone into shock. Rowan had seen her rage and kill and laugh and weep, but he had never seen her lost. And he hated himself for it, but he couldn't find a way out. Couldn't find a way for her to get out of this. Aelin was sleeping soundly as Rowan stared at the ceiling above their bed, then slid his gaze over her. He took in the lines of her face, the golden waves of her hair, every moon-white scar and dark swirl of ink. Leaning in, silent as snow in a wood, he kissed her brow. He would not let it end here, not let this be what broke them. He knew the house flags that flew beneath Maeve's own crest, had counted and catalogued them all day, sorting through the catacombs of his memory. Rowan slid into his clothes and waited until he'd crept into the hall before buckling his sword belt. Still gripping the doorknob, he allowed himself one last look at her. For a moment, the past snared him. For a moment, he saw her as he'd first spied her, on the rooftops of Varez, drunk and battered. He'd been in hawk form, assessing his new charge, and she'd noticed him, broken and reeling. She had still spotted him there, and stuck out her tongue at him. If someone had told him that the drunken, brawling, bitter woman would become the one thing he could not live without. Rowan shut the door. This was all he could offer her. Rowan reached the main deck and shifted, little more than a gleam of moonlight, as he shielded himself and flapped through the briny night into the heart of Maeve's fleet. Rowan's cousin had enough good sense not to try to kill him on sight. They were close enough in age that Rowan had grown up with him, raised in his uncle's house beside him after his parents had faded. If his uncle ever faded, it would be Enda who took up the mantle as head of their house, a prince of considerable title, property, and arms. Enda, to his credit, sensed his arrival before Rowan slipped through the flimsy shield on the windows. Ananda remained sitting on the bed, albeit dressed for battle, a hand on his sword. His cousin looked him over head to toe as Rowan shifted.
"Assassin or messenger, Prince?"
"Neither," Rowan said, inclining his head slightly. Like him, Enda was silver-haired, though his green eyes were speckled with brown that could sometimes swallow the color whole when he was in a rage. If Rowan had been bred and built for battlefields, Enda was sculpted for intrigue and court machinations. His cousin, while tall and muscled enough, lacked Rowan's breadth of shoulders and solid bulk, though that could also be from the different sorts of training they'd received. Enda knew enough about fighting to warrant being here to lead his father's forces. But their own educations had crossed little after those first decades of youth, when they had run wild together at his family's main estate. Enda kept his hand on the hilt of his fine sword, utterly calm.
"You look different," his cousin said, brows twitching toward each other. "Better."
There had been a time when Enda had been his friend. Before Lyria. Before everything. And Rowan might have been inclined to explain who and what was responsible for this change. But he didn't have time. No. Time was not his ally this night. But Rowan said,
"You look different as well, Prince."
Enda gave a half-smile.
"You can thank my mate for that."
Once it might have sent a pang of agony through him. That Enda spoke of it reminded him that his cousin might not be a battle-honed warrior, but the courtier was as good as any at marking important details, noting Aelin's scent, now forever entwined with his own. So Rowan nodded, smiling a bit himself.
"It was Lord Kerrigan's son, wasn't it?"
Indeed, there was another scent woven through Enda's, the claiming deep and true.
"It was."
Enda again smiled, now at a ring on his finger.
"We were mated and married earlier this summer."
"You mean to tell me you waited 100 years for him?"
Enda shrugged, his grip on his sword lightening.
"When it comes to the right person, Prince, waiting 100 years is worth it."
He knew. He understood him so damn well that it made his chest crack to think of it.
"Endymion,"
he said hoarsely.
"Enda, I need you to listen."
There were plenty of people who might have called for the guards, but he knew Enda, or had. He was but one of several cousins who'd shoved their noses into his business for years. Tried, Rowan now wondered, not for gossip, but to fight to keep some small scrap of him alive. Enda more than any of them. So Endymion gave him the gift of listening. Rowan tried to keep it concise, tried to keep his hands from trembling. In the end, he supposed his request was simple. When he finished, Enda studied him, any response hidden behind that court-trained mask of neutrality. Then Enda said,
"I will consider it."
It was the best Rowan could hope for. He said nothing else to his cousin before he shifted again and flapped into the night toward another banner he had once marched beside. And ship to ship, Rowan went. The same speech, the same request. All of them, all his cousins, had the same answer. "I will consider it." Chapter 62. Manon was awake when Dorian stormed into her room an hour before dawn. He ignored her unlaced shirt, the swell of those lush breasts he'd tasted only yesterday, as he said,
"Put your clothes on and follow me."
Mercifully, the witch obeyed, though he had a feeling it was mostly from curiosity. When he reached Aelin's chamber, he bothered to knock, just in case the queen and Rowan were utilizing their potentially last few hours together. But the queen was already awake and dressed, the prince nowhere to be found. Aelin took one look at Dorian's face.
"What is it?"
He didn't tell either woman anything as he led them down into the cargo hold, the upper levels of the ship already astir with battle preparations. While they'd debated and readied for the past day, he'd contemplated Manon's warning after she'd made his very blood sing with pleasure.
"Unless you would like to learn precisely what parts of me are made from iron the next time you touch me, I decide those things."
Over and over, he'd considered the way the words had snagged on a sharp corner of his memory. He'd lain awake all night while he descended into his still-depleted well of magic. And as the light had begun to shift, Dorian tugged the sheet off the witch mirror carefully held in place against the wall. The lock, or whatever it was. In the muted reflection, the two queens were frowning at his back. Manon's iron nails slid out. "I would be careful handling that if I were you."
"The warning is noted and appreciated," he said, meeting those gold eyes in the mirror.
She didn't return his smile. Neither did Aelin. He sighed.
"I don't think this witch mirror has any power, or rather not a tangible brute power. I think its power is knowledge."
Aelin's steps were near silent as she approached. "I was told the lock would allow me to bind the three keys into the gate. You think this mirror knows how to do that?" He simply nodded, trying not to be too offended by the skepticism scrunching her face. Aelin picked at a loose thread on her jacket. "But what does the lock mirror, whatever it is, have to do with the armada breathing down our necks?" He tried not to roll his eyes.
"It has to do with what Deanna said. What if the lock wasn't just for binding them back into the gate, but a tool for safely controlling the keys?"
Aelin frowned at the mirror. "So I'm going to lug that thing onto the deck and use it to blow apart Maeve's armada with the two keys we have?" He took a steadying breath, beseeching the gods for patience.
"I said I think this mirror's power is knowledge. I think it will show you how to wield the keys safely, so you can come back here and wield them without consequence."
A slow blink.
"What do you mean, come back here?"
Manon answered, now stepping close as she studied the mirror.
"It's a traveling mirror."
Dorian nodded.
"Think about Deanna's words. Flame and iron, together bound, merge into silver to learn what must be found. A mere step is all it shall take."
He pointed to the mirror.
"Step into the silver and learn."
Manon clicked her tongue. "And I suppose she and I are flame and iron." Aelin crossed her arms. Dorian cut the Queen of Terrasen a wry glance.
"People other than you can solve things, you know."
Aelin glared at him. "We don't have time for what ifs. Too many things could go wrong."
"You have little magic left," Dorian countered,
waving a hand toward the mirror.
"You could be in and out of this mirror before dawn, and use what you learn to send Maeve a message in no uncertain terms."
"I can still fight with steel, without the risks and waste of time."
"You can stop this battle before the losses are too great on either side."
he added carefully.
We're out of time already, Aelin.
Those turquoise eyes were steady. If not still furious, he'd beat her to the riddle. But something flickered in them.
I know, she said.
I was hoping... She shook her head, more at herself.
I ran out of time,
she murmured as if it were an answer, and considered the mirror, then Manon, then blew out a breath. This wasn't my plan.
I know, Dorian said with a half-smile. That's why you don't like it.
Manon asked before Aelin could bite off his head. But where will the mirror lead? Aelin clenched her jaw. Hopefully not Morath. Dorian tensed. Perhaps this plan... That symbol belongs to both of us, Manon said, studying the eye of Elena etched onto it. And if it takes you to Morath, you're going to need someone who knows the way out. Steps thudded down the stairs at the back of the hold. Dorian twisted toward them, but Aelin smirked at Manon and approached the mirror. Then I'll see you on the other side, witch. Adian's golden head appeared between the crates.
What the hell are you-
Aelin's shallow nod seemed all that Manon needed. She placed her hand atop Aelin's. Golden eyes met Dorian's for a moment, and he opened his mouth to say something to her. The words surging from some barren field in his chest. But Aelin and Manon pressed their joined hands to the speckled glass. Adian's shout of warning rang through the hold as they vanished. Chapter 63 Elide watched the ship rally against the armada looming before them, then descend into utter chaos. As Adian began roaring below. The news came out moments later. Came out as Prince Rowan Whitethorn landed on the main deck, face haggard, eyes full of nothing but fear as Adian burst out the door, Dorian on his heels, sporting an already nasty bruise around his eye. Pacing, seething, Adian told them of Aelin and Manon walking into the mirror, the lock, and vanishing. How the King of Otterlin had solved Deanna's riddle and sent them into its silvery realm to buy them a shot at this battle. They went down into the cargo hold. But no matter how Adian pushed against the mirror, it did not open to him. No matter how Rowan searched it with his magic, it did not yield where Aelin and Manon had gone. Adian had spat on the floor, looking inclined to give the king another black eye. As Dorian explained, there had been little choice. He hadn't seemed sorry about it, until Rowan refused to meet his gaze. Only when they were gathered on the deck again, the king and shapeshifter off speaking to the captain about the turn of events, did Elide carefully say to Adian as he paced,
What is done. We can't wait for Aelin and Manon to find a way to save us.
Adian halted, and Elide tried not to cringe at the unrelenting fury as it narrowed on her.
When I want your opinion about how to deal with my missing queen, I'll ask you.
Lorcan snarled at him, but Elide lifted her chin, even as the insult hit something in her chest.
I waited as long as you did to find her again, Adian. You are not the only one who fears to lose her once more.
Indeed, Rowan Whitethorn now rubbed his face. She suspected it was as much feeling as the Fae Prince would show. Rowan lowered his hands, the others watching him, waiting for his orders. Even Adian. Elide started as realization slapped her, as she searched for proof, but found none.
We continue readying for battle, Rowan said hoarsely.
He looked to Lorcan, then Fenris and Gavriel, and his entire countenance changed, his shoulders pushing back, his eyes turning hard and calculating.
"There's not a chance in hell Maeve doesn't know you're here. She'll wield the Blood Oath when it'll hurt us the most."
Maeve. Some small part of her wished to see the queen who could command Lorkin's relentless focus and affection for so many centuries, and perhaps give Maeve a piece of her mind. Fenris put a hand on the hilt of his sword, and said with more quiet than Elide had witnessed so far,
"I don't know how to play this one."
Indeed, Gavriel seemed at a loss, scanning his tattooed hands as if the answer lay there. It was Lorkin who said,
"If you're spotted fighting on this side, it's over. She'll either kill you both or make you regret it in other ways."
"And what about you?" Fenris challenged. Lorkin's eyes slid to hers, then back to the males before them.
"It was over for me months ago. It's now a matter of waiting to see what she'll do about it."
If she'd kill him, or drag him back in chains. Elide's stomach turned, and she avoided the urge to grab his hand, to beg him to run.
"She'll see that we've worked our way around her order to kill you,"
Gabriel at last said.
"If fighting on this side of the line doesn't damn us enough, then that surely will. It likely already has."
"Dawn's still half an hour off, if you two want to try again,"
Lorkin crooned. Elide tensed. But it was Fenris who said,
"It's all a ploy."
Elide held her breath as she surveyed the Fey males, his companions.
"To fracture us when Maeve knows that unified we could present a considerable threat."
"We'd never turn on her,"
Gavriel countered.
"No," Fenris agreed, "but we would offer that strength to another."
And he looked at Rowan as he said,
"When we got your call for aid this spring, when you asked us to come defend Mistward, we left before Maeve could get wind of it. We ran."
"That's enough,"
Lorkin growled. But Fenris went on, holding Rowan's steady gaze.
"When we returned, Maeve whipped us within an inch of our lives, tied Lorkin to the posts for 2 days and let Cairn whip him whenever he wished. Lorkin ordered us not to tell you, for whatever reason. But I think Maeve saw what we did together in Mistward, and realized how dangerous we could be. To her."
Rowan didn't hide the devastation in his eyes as he faced Lorkin. Devastation that Elide felt echo in her own heart. Lorkin had endured that, and still remained loyal to Maeve. Elide brushed her fingers against his. The motion didn't go unnoticed by the others, but they wisely kept quiet about it, especially as Lorkin dragged his thumb down the back of her hand in answer. And Elide wondered if Rowan also understood that Lorkin hadn't ordered their silence for strategy, but perhaps to spare the prince from guilt, from wanting to retaliate against Maeve in a way that would surely harm him.
"Did you know,"
Rowan said hoarsely to Lorkin, "that she'd punish you before you came to Mistward?"
Lorkin held the prince's stare.
"We all knew what the cost would be."
Rowan's throat bobbed, and he took a long breath, his eyes darting toward the stairs, as if Aelin would come prowling out, salvation in hand. But she didn't. And Elide prayed that wherever the queen now was, she was gleaning what they so desperately needed to learn. Rowan said to his companions,
"You know how this battle will likely end. Even if our armada teamed with Fey soldiers, we'd still have the odds stacked against us."
The sky began to bleed with pink and purple as the sun stirred beneath the distant waves. Gavriel only said,
"We have had the odds stacked against us before."
A glance at Fenris, who nodded gravely.
"We will stay until we are commanded otherwise."
It was to Adian that Gavriel looked as he said this last piece. There was something in the general's Ash River eyes that looked almost like gratitude. Elide sensed Lorkin's attention and found him still watching her as he said to Rowan,
"Elide gets to shore, under a guard of whatever men you can spare. My sword is yours, only if you do that."
Elide started, but Rowan said,
"Done."
Rowan spread them across the fleet, each given command of a few ships. He stationed Fenris, Lorkin, and Gavriel on ships toward the center and back, farthest away from Maeve's notice. He and Adian took the front lines, with Dorian and Ansel commanding the line of ships behind his. Lysandre was already beneath the waves in sea dragon form, ready for his order to do damage to hull and prow and rudder on ships he'd marked for her. He'd bet that while the Fae ships might have shields around them, they wouldn't waste valuable reservoirs of power on shielding below the surface. Lysandre would strike quick and hard, gone before they could realize who and what wrecked them from below. Dawn broke, clear and bright, staining the sails with gold. Rowan did not let himself think of Aelin, of wherever she might be. Minute after minute passed, and still Aelin did not return. A small oak rowboat slid out from Maeve's fleet and headed for him. There were only three people on it, none of them Maeve. He could feel thousands of eyes on either side of that too narrow band of empty water between their armadas, watching that boat approach, watching him. A male in Maeve's livery stood with preternatural fey balance as the oarsman held the boat steady.
"Her Majesty awaits your reply."
Rowan tunneled into his depleted reserve of power, keeping his face bland.
"Inform Maeve that Aelin Galathinius is no longer present to give a reply."
A blink from the male was all the shock he'd let show. Maeve's creatures were too well trained, too aware of the punishment for revealing her secrets.
"Princess Aelin Galathinius is ordered to surrender," the male said. "Queen Aelin Galathinius is not on this ship or any other in this fleet. She is in fact not on the shore or in any nearby lands. So Maeve will find she came a long way for nothing. We will leave your armada in peace if you will grant us the same courtesy."
The male sneered up at him.
"Spoken like cowards who know they're outnumbered. Spoken like a traitor."
Rowan gave the male a small smile.
"Let's see what Maeve has to say now."
The male spat into the water, but the ship rode back into the embrace of the armada. For a moment, Rowan recalled his last words to Dorian before he'd sent the king to shield his own line of ships. They were beyond apologies. Aelin would either return or... He didn't let himself consider the alternative, but they could buy her as much time as possible, try to fight their way out, for her, and the future of this armada. Dorian's face had revealed the same thoughts as he clasped hands with him, and said quietly,
"It is not such a hard thing, is it, to die for your friends?"
Rowan didn't bother insisting they were going to live through this. The king had been tutored in warfare, even if he hadn't yet practiced it. So Rowan had given him a grim smile and replied,
"No, it is not."
The words echoed through him again as that messenger's boat disappeared. And for whatever good it would do, whatever time it would buy them, Rowan reinforced his shields again. The sun had fully risen over the horizon when Maeve's reply came. Not a messenger in a longboat, but a barrage of arrows, so many that they blotted out the light as they arced across the sky.
"Shield!"
Rowan bellowed, not only at the magic wielders, but also at the armed men who raised their dented and battered shields above them, as arrows rained across the line. The arrow struck, and his magic buckled under their onslaught. Their tips had been wrapped in magic of their own, and Rowan gritted his teeth against it. On other ships, where the shield was stretched thin, some men screamed. Maeve's armada began crawling toward them. Chapter 64. Aelin had a body that was not a body. She knew only because in this void, this foggy twilight, Manon had a body. A nearly transparent wraith-like body. But a form nonetheless. Manon's teeth and nails glinted in the dim light as she surveyed the swirling gray mists.
What is this place?
The mirror had transported them to wherever this was. Your guess is as good as mine, witch. Had time stopped beyond the mists? Had Maeve held her fire upon learning she was not present, or attacked anyway? Aelin had no doubt Rowan would hold the lines for as long as possible, had no doubt he and Adian would lead them, but whether the witch mirror was the lock she'd sought, she'd expected it to have some immediate reaction to the two word keys she'd snuck into her jacket. Not this. Not absolutely nothing. Aelin drew Goldrin. In the mist, the sword's ruby flickered. The only color. Only light. Manon said,
"We stick close. We only speak when necessary."
Aelin was inclined to agree. There was solid ground beneath them, but the mist hid her feet, hid any inkling that they stood on dirt beyond a faint, crumbling scraping. "Any guess which way?" Aelin murmured. But they didn't have to decide. The eddying fog darkened, and Manon and Aelin stepped close together, back to back. Pure night swept around them, blinding them. Then, a murky, dim light ahead. No, not ahead. Approaching them. Manon's bony shoulder dug into her own as they pressed tighter together, an impenetrable wall. But the light rippled and expanded, figures within it appearing, solidifying. Aelin knew three things as the light and color enveloped them and became tangible. They were not seen, or heard, or scented by those before them. And this was the past. 1,000 years ago, to be exact. And that was Elena Galathinius on her knees in a black, barren mountain pass, blood dripping from her nose, tears sliding through the dirt crusting her face to splatter on her armor, an obsidian sarcophagus somehow stationed before her. All across the sarcophagus, word marks simmered with pale blue fire. And in the center of it, the eye of Elena, the amulet held within the stone itself. Its pale gold unvarnished and gleaming. Then, as if a phantom breath blew over it, the eye dimmed, along with the word marks. Elena reached with a trembling hand to twist the eye, rotating it thrice in the black stone. The eye clicked and tumbled into Elena's awaiting hand, sealing the sarcophagus. Locking it.
You've had the lock all along, Manon murmured. But then, the mirror.
I think, Aelin breathed, we have been deliberately misled about what we must retrieve.
Why?
Manon said with equal quiet.
I suppose we're about to find out.
A memory. That's what this was. But what was so vital that they had been sent to retrieve it when the whole damn world was falling apart around them? Aelin and Manon stood in silence as the scene unfolded. As the truth, at last the truth, now wove together. Chapter 65. Dawn at the Obsidian Passes. The lock had crafted the sarcophagus from the mountain itself. It had taken every ember of its power to bind Erewhon within the stone, to seal him inside. She could feel the Dark King sleeping within, hear the shrieks of his fell army feasting on human flesh in the valley far below. How long would they continue fighting, when word spread that Erewhon had fallen? She wasn't foolish enough to hope her companions had survived the slaughter. Not this long. On her knees in the sharp black rock, Elena gazed at the obsidian sarcophagus, the symbols carved into it. They initially had been glowing, but had now faded and cooled, settled into place. When she had stolen the lock from her father all those months ago, she had not known, had not understood the true depth of its power. Still did not know why he had forged it. Only that once, just once, could the lock's power be wielded. And that power, oh, that mighty, shattering power, it had saved them all. Gavin, sprawled and bloody behind her, stirred. His face was so mangled she could barely see the handsome, fierce features beneath. His left arm was useless at his side. The price of distracting Erewhon while she'd unleashed the lock's power. But even Gavin had not known what she'd been planning, what she'd stolen and harbored all these months. She did not regret it, not when it had spared him from death. Worse. Gavin took in the sarcophagus, the empty, intricate amulet of the lock in her palm, as it rested on her thigh. He recognized it instantly, having seen it around her father's neck during those initial weeks in Orinth. The blue stone in its center was now drained, dim, where it had only flickered with inner fire. Barely a drop of its power left, if that.
What have you done?
His voice was a broken rasp from screaming during Erewhon's ministrations. To buy her time. To save their people. Elena folded her fingers into a fist around the lock.
He is sealed. He cannot escape.
Your father's lock.
It is done, she said, shifting her attention to the dozen ancient immortal figures now on the other side of the sarcophagus. Gavin started, hissing at his broken body with the sudden movement. They had no forms. They were only figments of light and shadow, wind and rain, song and memory. Each individual, and yet a part of one majority, one consciousness. They were all gazing at the broken lock in her hands, its stone dull. Gavin lowered his brow to the blood-soaked rock and averted his eyes. Elena's very bones quailed in their presence, but she kept her chin high.
Our sister's bloodline has betrayed us,
said one that was of sea and sky and storms. Elena shook her head, trying to swallow. Failing.
I saved us. I stopped Erewhon.
Fool,
said the one of many shifting voices, both animal and human. Half-breed.